Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you for tuning in. Today we have Deepak Ramola coming on. Guys, I've done a lot of interviews. Usually it's people in their late 20s, 30s, 40s. This guy, he's 25 years old, started a project when he was only 14. And at 17 was offered a book deal, which he turned down. The project is called Project Fuel. And he collects life lessons from people all over the world and turns them into interactive performance activities so that he can pass those learnings on instead of as inspirational quotes, as actual experiential learning. I don't know where he gets this from. It's like I was talking to the oldest soul I've ever met. I had goosebumps multiple times during the episode. Tune in for just a wonderful spirit, a wonderful human being. You can find out more about him at projectfuel.in. Again, Deepak Ramola coming on to share this beautiful story, what he's achieved in his young 25 years. I feel like I haven't gotten to that spiritual depth in my whole life. Thank you so much for tuning in. Check it out. Love to hear from you guys. Send me a note. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you love. Any questions, anything you want me to speak to. I love hearing from you. For those of you who have taken the time to write in, thank you so much. Each of your notes means the world to me. Thank you for joining us for this week's episode. Today we have Deepak Ramola joining us. Hey Deepak, how are you?
Hi, Laura. I'm very good. So excited to speak with you and be on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm excited because we were chatting before the show. Deepak is calling in all the way from a rural town in India. So yes. You will understand more when we talk a little bit more about Deepak and what he's up to. But just to introduce, he's running a program called Project Fuel that he founded in 2009. And it collects life lessons from people all over the world. And he turns that into interactive performance activity. So Deepak is actually literally calling us from a remote town where he is doing such a thing. Tell us about your day today.
Oh, wow. It was a pretty amazingly intense day, Laura, because this is a very rural, you know, community working. And especially the girls who come here come from very marginalized communities. And they are studying to be eye surgeons and studying to be eye doctors and as well footballers. So you see such inspiration-loaded females in a very rural, conservative part of the country. And you get to spend an entire day with them, interviewing them, listening to their stories, sharing with them life lessons of other women around the world. And it was just very emotionally enriching and very, very heartwarming to hear their stories and inspirations. So I'm glad I had a good day with them today.
Amazing. Amazing. I can't even imagine what that experience was like. And so Deepak, like, this is quite the project. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people who do, you know, very interesting things with their life, but what inspired Project Fuel? I mean, what inspired you to get out around the world and start collecting these life lessons? It's just an incredible journey to embark on.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm glad it resonates with you. And it started as a personal inspiration from my mother, actually. My mother was pulled out of school in grade 5 by her grandmother back in 1960s, you know, when they didn't allow really girls to study or go to school with boys and study at all. And my mother suffered in the hands of that mentality at the time, and her grandmother pulled her out of school. So my mother would always say to me and my sister that you should study, because I didn't have the opportunity to go through books and read and, you know, go to school. And I really wanted to do that. And I never believed her because she was one of the smartest people I knew. She would argue with my dad, win with the most mic drop moments in the house, you know, like a professional debater. She would take the salary of my dad and manage the finances of the house. She was raising 2 teenage kids. So I was pretty confused and perplexed that a woman who said she never went to school knows so much. So at the age of 14, I walked up to my mother one day frustrated and I said, "You must be the biggest liar on planet Earth, because you say you didn't go to school, but everything they teach us in school is exactly what you do." And my mother sort of laughed and said, "I didn't go to school, but I've been paying attention to everything life has been teaching me. And that's how I know what I know." And to my 14-year-old brain, that was quite a statement, because I thought, well, if she is learning simply by living, that means everyone who's living is learning something. And if I could collect all of that information and all of that wisdom in the world, I would never make another mistake by the time I turn 16 or 17. It is only to realize much later that, of course, you cannot avoid mistakes in the world. But what knowing life lessons or knowing wisdom of other people does is that it doesn't harness you as mistakes, but it does harness you against the most repeated and common mistakes. Like, why would you want to do the same mistake that 4 billion people already did and know what happens at the end of the story? Knowing people's life lessons gives you the power to try something absolutely new, unique, and never done before. And that's what thrills me about this project the most.
That's amazing. What a story. I mean, I have to say, I was like feeling a little emotional for a second there. What a beautiful tribute to your mother, and that was such a life-changing experience. I have a young son and it's beautiful. So you started this company in 2009. You start collecting life lessons. Tell me about what that looks like. So you're just getting a pen and paper and you start talking to random people. Like, how do you find the people to talk to? What does that mean?
That's a wonderful question, because there are as many ways as there are people in the world. When I started at 14, it really was like a very personal hobby project. I used to ask school teachers, classmates, relatives who were invited. At the age of 17 is when I started teaching these life lessons to others, and I mean, passing them on in terms of curriculums. And I was offered a book deal at the age of 17. And the publisher at the time said, you have amazing raw human wisdom. Let's just put it together. And that was my biggest fear, that I didn't want it to end up being a quote on the wall. You know, you read all of the Instagram motivation and then you do nothing about it most days.
Wait a minute. You're only 17 and you've got a book deal and you've been doing this. That's crazy. I did not quite get that in reading about you.
Oh, and I say no to the book deal. Can you imagine? That's what upset most people in my circuit. They were like, you are crazy. I didn't even actually tell most people about it, because I was like, that's not the goal. The goal with these life lessons is that people should be able to experience it. Someone has lived it, guys. Come on. Like, the least we can do is make someone experience it for at least 2 minutes of their lives. And so the process of collecting these life lessons became twofold. One was people I was interviewing, and it wasn't really specific celebrities or media figures or Bollywood stars. It was really common people. Like, I would sit with beggars on the streets. I would meet eunuchs. I would speak to janitors. I would speak to bus conductors and waiters and say, hey, what is life teaching you? And it was so beautiful that it compelled me to go out and teach it. And when I would finish a class, I would take their life lessons and then teach those life lessons in the next class. So it became like a self-sustaining model content-wise. And now over the years, of course, with the work spreading and with my working in different parts of the world, a lot of people do send in their life lessons through the website, through the Facebook page, and all the social media handles that you have available. So that's the process kind of looks like.
Oh my God, what a precocious young child. I mean, now that you're older, you have to at least acknowledge that is not like what most 14-year-olds are thinking about. So you start gathering these. You don't want it to be in a book. You don't want it to be inspirational, eventually Instagram, you know, just quotes, which I get. But explain to me in the audience, what do you mean by experiential? Like, so you want to have the person experience the life lesson. Can you give us an example of what that looks like? Give us an example of a life lesson and then how that turns into an exercise or an experience?
Sure. So what I mean by that it has to be experiential is that most life lessons, not all, but most life lessons is what I try to design into activities of theater, poetry, creative writing, and performance art. For example, there's a beautiful life lesson by a 23-year-old girl that says, don't be in denial. Her life taught her at the age of 23 that if you're in denial, you don't have a solution. So the activity I designed for it was that you ask every student or every participant in the class to write the biggest problem they are in denial of on a small chit of paper. And then you collect all of these chits, but you ask everybody to not write their name. So it's anonymous problems. So I was teaching at a hill school in India 2-3 years ago, and I did this activity where I asked them to write their problems without their names in a different handwriting. And once I collected all these problems in small sheets of paper, shuffled them up, wrote every problem on the board one by one, and told the class, now nobody knows in a class of 110, 120 people whose life problem this is. So feel free to give 5 practical solutions to each problem. And what happened 20 minutes into the exercise is a chit opened up and it said, I'm a drug addict and I don't know how to quit and I really want to. So I told the class, I am the worst person to give advice on that. So if you can open your minds and hearts and offer something. So one of the students raised his hand in the class and said, I know that one of the things one can do is you confess to the loved ones, because as a drug addict, one of your biggest fears is to come back to your parents and your parents saying, I know what you've been into. And that fear of being caught is very, very discouraging for a drug addict. So I wrote that, confess to loved ones. And then another student raised his hand and he said, I know the number of the best rehabilitation center in town. It is not so popular. My brother just came out of it. And if you want, I can give you the number. So here I am writing the number on the board and I say, okay, whoever's problem it is, please note down the number. Now you can imagine 110, 120 kids in the class all waiting for someone's pen to move in order for them to see whose problem it is. But I make everybody write down the number. And Laura, you won't believe it, literally 3 months, 2 days later, I get a call from the school principal saying that a student wants to speak to you over the phone. So I get on the call and this guy says, can you please tell that girl whose life lesson saved my life that I'm free of drugs? Because now I am out of the rehabilitation center. And I went home and I told my parents that, hey, I fell into bad company. I really need help. I'm a drug addict. They panicked. I said, don't panic. I have the number of the best rehabilitation center in town. Just get me there by tomorrow morning.
Deepak, you're killing me. This is so incredible.
And I mean, of course, there are thousands and hundreds of stories of that sort. But imagine a girl in Bangalore, India, who hasn't met this boy in the northeast of India ever and has solved the biggest crisis in his life with what she knows best is true for herself. And the same applies to sex workers and refugees in Europe that I've worked with. You know, you can really pass on them in through these mediums.
You just say that so matter-of-factly, like... And it just works with sex workers. And what? Like, I'm sure everybody is having the experience I am, or I'm just going to go out there and say I'm having that experience. You work with sex workers? And what do you mean by that?
So sex workers in India.
I'm like babbling on over here because I'm a little speechless, I have to be honest.
No, not a problem. I mean, it's such an honor to share these stories with you and your audience. I'm such a huge admirer and I'm glad that I'm getting to share. But what I mean by that is, literally, sex workers and prostitutes and trafficked girls who work as sex workers in India, I've had the privilege of documenting their wisdom, and I've had the privilege of working with their daughters as well, who fortunately are now out of the sex trade, and refugees in Europe. So last year, Laura, I was on a 100-day tour across Europe, staying in 5 countries from refugee camp to refugee camp, documenting life lessons of refugees, predominantly displaced by the conflict in Syria, but also from Sudan and Eritrea and Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan, and collecting those life lessons in the camp, but teaching it to the native population in Sweden, Germany, France, Hungary, and Netherlands. And if you allow, I'll share an example of one of the refugee life lessons and how that got converted into an activity.
Please, I'm captivated by you. Please go ahead.
Okay. I met a refugee in the south of France in a refugee camp called Calais, which is one of the most volatile camps. And he said that his life as a refugee had taught him that the resource means nothing if you don't have accessibility to use it. You know, you can call me over to your house, you can say you have your extra room, but if you don't look me in the eye in the breakfast or during the day or never have a conversation, that house means nothing, you know. And I was so moved by that because I thought most of the refugees are going through that resource versus accessibility problem. So I was working with a group that did not like refugees in Hungary. I'm quite a risk taker, I must tell you, in that sense. And I designed an activity on the tour. I gave every participant in the room a balloon. And I told them the goal of the activity is to blow the balloon. But there are 2 rules. Rule 1 is you cannot use your hands. And rule 2 is you cannot use your mouth. So now you have the most intellectual crowd in a room, flabbergasted by this young boy from India, asking them to blow a balloon without hands and mouth. And I see them being frustrated for 5 minutes. So after 5 minutes, I say, okay, let's dissolve rule one. You can use your hands. And then they do what most human beings would do, is put it up their nostrils and try to blow it, because you still can't use your mouth, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And then choke onto it and just get more frustrated because now they're choking on and unable to breathe and all of that. And so 10 minutes later, I tell them, okay, let's dissolve rule two. You can use your hands and you can use your mouth, and here you go. Within less than 15 seconds, all 30 people in the room not only blew their balloon, they tied a knot around it, started playing with it. And that's when I actually revealed the picture and the life lesson of the refuge. And I said, wait a minute. Now, if the balloon is the resource and the two permissions are the accessibility, even the most simple task on planet Earth to blow a balloon can cause you 10 minutes of frustration, so much of anger, and bring forth so much of lack of intellect, you know?
Yeah.
That's the most amazing and well-read people. So imagine when a refugee comes to your country and you say, oh, well, he has a place to stay, a roof over his head. What does he want? What he wants is a smile at the grocery store. What he really wants is an accessibility to feeling like a community, feeling like a new home. And you should have seen people's reaction in the room.
Oh.
It was right.
Okay, Deepak, you have hit the highest amount of goosebumps I've gotten on any interview. This is how are you not on Oprah telling this story? It's incredible. How do you come up with these ideas? I mean, I understand the life lesson, but how do you back into the balloons? Where does that come from?
Wow, that actually is a difficult question, because it's a really nubious process, Laura. I cannot really pinpoint on, oh, this is the formula one to formula two. It comes from a lot of research. It comes from a lot of understanding of the life lesson and how the person wants to convey it. Does he want it to be preached? Does he want it to be practiced? And then it boils down to, what are my resources? Generally, when you're traveling as an educator and a young educator who's 25 and looks 17 and was 17 and looked 14, I mean, I had to battle that all my life. So convincing people takes most of the session than the session itself early on in the career. So you have to think of economical resources. So when I think of an activity, I think of what is present in the class. Everybody will have a pen. Everyone will have a paper. Balloons are not that hard to carry. So you think of all of these economical solutions to your travel and luggage and resources being provided by the institution. So that's, I mean, kind of how it happens. But of course, I do a lot of research on how to psychologically impact accessibility to someone. And a lot of, because as an artist, I mean, sometimes I get these visual references. For example, for this balloon one particularly, I actually was thinking, like, what is the simplest task you can actually give someone and make it the most difficult? Something was with eating, I thought first, because eating should be the easiest, or with water drinking. But who would carry all of that? So I thought, well, balloons seem fun. They are visually as well. Good fun. So, yeah.
So basically what I think you're trying to tell me is you're just extraordinarily talented, which is what I'm gathering from this interview. And how do you pay for all of this? I mean, where did the money come to fund the travel and your time? And I'm sure this takes more than you. You probably have a team of people. How does this get funded?
So right now, the Project Fuels funding model is that we get paid for the sessions I do with corporates and some of the private schools. So we get paid from that. And once we meet the operative cost, which is the salaries, the office rent, all the money goes back into doing projects with the marginalized community. So it's a very Robin Hood mechanism. You take from the people who have it and pass it on to the people who don't have it and would want to experience what you're wanting to convey. So that's how it works. For the refugee tour, of course, we crowdfund and we seek a lot of grants and write donations for donations. So for crowdfunding, we raise money for us to travel for these 100 days across Europe and live in the refugee camps and interview people. So that's where primarily the funding is involved.
I understand. So if people went to your website today, I didn't notice, do you have a regular location for people to donate?
The money right now?
If somebody were listening today and wanted to donate to your fund, is it something that you take on a regular basis, or is it something you do as needed?
Oh, no, we do accept donations for projects all year round. But the policy at Project Fuel is you cannot give your money before you give your life lesson. So you first need to write an email, share with us your wisdom, and allow us to take that wisdom to other people and for us to share some wisdom with you that we have documented over the years. And that's when you can actually share your money too. So it's not just, oh, you give your money, because I feel like there's so many people who have huge deposits of wealth bank balance, but when you ask for the deposit of their wisdom, that's very rare. So it's to encourage that as well, you know, because some of the biggest philanthropic families and individuals I've met in conferences and summits around the world, you ask them, you have earned so much money, it must have taught you something. And they're like, yes. And I was like, when the money is over, do your kids know what you've learned? And they're like, no. Well, great.
That's amazing.
That's going to last, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible. I think it's a real gift to give to people, to give them an opportunity to think about the life lesson. And you've collected 153,000 of them. Is that the right number?
Yes.
Oh my God.
In fact, a little more than that since the website got updated. But yeah, it's more than that. Yeah, now coming.
So you've been at this since 2009. What is the goal? Like, do you just do this tirelessly until you just find that this isn't what you want to do? Do you have like an end goal in mind? Like, how do you think about this?
I think, Laura, in very initial context, the theme song of this whole work and of the vision of it all has been to make each life count, you know. Not everybody can be an amazing show host like you, cannot be an educator like me or an artist like someone else. And it is to reach the last person in the row and the last person in the queue to say, you matter and your life is worth it, you know. So for people to be able to reflect on to that, hey, I've not really been popular, I've not really been rich, but I've had a great, simple life. And I want to share the understandings of that life with other people. And if people are able to condense that wisdom and share it with others for the benefit of the overall good, I think you make each life count, the life that has reflected and resonated and given, and even the lives who receive the life lessons and say, wow, that's the solution to my life, like the drug addict or the refugee seeking accessibility. So the first goal is to make each life count, as philosophical as that sounds, but I mean, quite a reality.
That's beautiful. And
thank you so much. And the second is to make it a culture, you know, where people do not need an organization to remind them that what they're learning is valuable. They do it themselves. So you don't have a 17-year-old start so early and work towards it. It should be so rooted in your belief systems, hopefully by the end of my life and the coming up of the next generation, that they do it as a way of life and not as a way of, oh, there's a project running in India that's asking me to do it, you know?
So does your mother just like cry all day long with pride and joy for what you do? I can't even imagine.
Quite contrary, actually. You don't know Indian mothers, Laura. You really ought to meet my mother. She first of all, she says all your checks should come to me because this is my idea. Which never happens. I said, no, they're going to go back to society. She, of course, jokes about it. And my mother is, of course, very grateful that I am able to serve a lot of people, but very critical. She says, you know, there are 7 billion plus people on planet Earth. In fact, Monday I was like, you know, I've taught more than 62,000 people. And she was like, yeah, you know what your goal is. I said, what? And she said, I just asked, because she, of course, doesn't know how to read and write. So she asked my dad to Google what the population of the world is. And he found out that the population of the world was 7.124 billion on that day. And she was like, 62,000 is not impressive at all.
Oh,
I was like, wow, great. Great motivation at home.
Brutal. I mean, I am a Jewish, so I do. I have some connection to the standards that are impossible to meet, but Well, I, for one, will say I have a 10-year-old son, 11-year-old. If he were to go out and do anything like this, I would be brewing with pride. It's incredible that you have committed your time and your life. And it's such a, it feels like a business that really feels like a piece of art. And I think it's just amazing. So I ask everybody who comes on the show, and I'd love to ask you then, with all these life lessons, everybody you've spoken to, what does an authentic life mean to you?
Wow, so powerful. An authentic life to me means to live in such a way that you really shine so bright that your light becomes someone else's spotlight. You know, I think it is one thing to live, but it is one thing to live so brutally in the best manner possible and with such over-optimism on most days when the world will pull you down, that becomes the energy that you reflect onto the world. That's what I think, that you shine so bright that your light becomes someone else's spotlight. And all the people you see as inspirations and as mentors and as beacons of light around the world, living or dead, you know, are the people who actually were shining so bright when they lived that now their light is our spotlight. And whether that's Maya Angelou's poetry, or whether that's Nelson Mandela's struggle, whether that's Gandhi's philosophy, whether that, I mean, you pick people around the world and you see what they have done and achieved, is for you to have that spotlight, for you to feel safe, you know, when you step on the stage.
Beautiful. Again, beautiful goosebumps. And so how do you keep the light within you shining when the world is pulling you down? What do you do to keep yourself attuned and alive at that level?
Two things, because I deal with people and really raw human emotions on a day-to-day basis, as we discussed on the beginning of the show. My normal day looks like this. Is first to consciously remind yourself that your talent is not your gift, it's your responsibility. You know, when you consider your talent to be your gift, you can be lethargic about it. You can be moody about it. There can be days I can say, oh my God, I just want to spend time like back home relaxing on a Sunday. I don't want to be in a rural community in India with these raw emotions crying through the day, passing on life lessons. But because I know I can do that, because I know I've trained myself into getting those stories out and convincing people about embracing those lessons and learning from others, I must show up. So I think that's the first thing that saves me on most days, is knowing, oh, I was given a talent, and knowing that it's not a gift, it's a responsibility, makes me want to do my best every day. And I'm sure it's the same with you, with the show, with the stories you are making your audience hear and get inspired from and resonate with, or say, oh, never thought about it that way before. Even all those contexts are fulfilling that responsibility. So that's first, that you consider your talent as your responsibility. The second I would say is also knowing that you stop yourself on the first negative thought. And this is, I mean, a daily routine exercise that I do to try to live the best in the moment is, you know, when we think of negative thoughts, you think of a negative thought and you say, oh, it's going to rain today. Okay, that's the first negative thought. And then you think, oh, it's going to rain today and I'm not going to make it to office. That's the second negative thought. And then you're like, oh my God, this is my fourth off this week in office or this month. Mm-hmm. My God, my boss hates me. That's the fourth thought. The fifth thought is everybody in the office hates me. The sixth thought is, my goodness, what am I trying to do with my life? And by the 10th thought, or whatever the chronological order is for most people, you will end up really feeling upset and negative without having resolved anything. So what I try to do on most days is, when I think of the first negative thought, I catch myself like a Jewish or an Indian mother scolding the child.
Yeah.
Of going and playing out in the sun. You say, oh, there you go, thinking the first negative thought, and soon you'll be pretty depressed too.
Yes.
So you catch yourself before the snowball effect happens. And it really works. In my case, it does. And I hope, I mean, it serves other people as well. But when you consciously take a decision of saying, stop it, not to me, no longer, you know, that's it. It really works. And then you work on what's the next best solution. Okay, it's going to rain. Are you going to go to office? Yes or no? And if you're going to stay home, how are you going to finish work? If you're going to go to office, what is the next best possible thing for you to do and reach? You know?
Yes.
So those two things, responsibility and catching yourself.
I love that. You know, I used a metaphor to describe what you're talking about through emotional, through, you know, what we do with food, but people, you know, to lose weight, you just have to notice, oh, I had a bite of ice cream. I'm going to stop. I'm not going to eat. Right. We all know that. We know that if we want to lose weight, it's stop, lower the calories, increase the exercise. And it's really pretty straightforward. And there's all sorts of mechanisms in the world to get that to happen. But with our emotional life, right, like people don't think of it as that straightforward. And it really is. It's just, you're consuming those negative thoughts one after the next, after the next, after the next. And it's the lack of consciousness. And then you wake up and you're like, I'm in the worst mood. And everybody wants to talk about the outcome. And it's like, well, yeah, of course you are, right? Because you just ate 600 emotional thoughts that were terrible. So it's that consciousness. And
it also that, you know, I mean, having spoken to people from almost all age groups in the world, I mean, I've spoken to people from age 4 to 100 years old with their life lessons. And if I've really understood something, it is really that, you know, you can actually train yourself in a certain way. And it, of course, sounds to people who do not practice or do not do it that, oh, wow, it's very difficult or it cannot be done, as you said, right? But if you really do adhere to it, you will start to understand that the complexities of the things that happen in life cannot outshine the simplicity of life overall. And if you take a moment and decision to keep it simple and be silly sometimes, you can go far and long.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, to your point, these things have been studied forever and, you know, people have already figured this out. So why we feel that, you know, we have to feel that this is a new idea. The practice of accepting what is in every moment is a philosophical concept that's been around for thousands of years. And that conversation we have with ourselves, oh, it's raining out today. And then we keep going and keep going. And then when we notice our thoughts, we say, oh my God, I'm such a bad person because I'm now being so negative. And then we start another negative conversation about I'm a bad person. And then we say, oh, I was listening to that podcast and I know I'm not supposed to talk negatively. I hate myself so much for talking negatively. And it just never ends, right? But it's really as simple as put the fork down and walk away from the table. Like just you know, turn the thoughts off, go do something enjoyable for 5 minutes, you know, like do some push-ups, anything to get yourself into a happier state of mind.
Or surround yourself with people who will act as your alarm clocks, you know. Everybody knows everything we are talking already. All we have to do on most days is be a good alarm clock, be a reminder to each other, you know.
Yes.
So the more you surround yourself with people who will act as that friendly, positive reminder to you, you can then sustain and survive and thrive.
Beautiful. And now you're working, you didn't do the book deal at 17, but you have something new coming out, the Resources for Life Lesson Journals. Do you want to tell the audience about that?
Oh, so exciting. I can sense joy rising in my heart as I speak about it because the first time I'm revealing that. In all these years of documenting wisdom and collecting life lessons, I have always been asked for people to say, oh, how can I do that for myself? Not just one life lesson, but how can I trace all the learnings? So finally, this year, Laura, after all of these years of research, we are actually putting together something called the Life Lesson Journal, which people can buy. And each page has a handcrafted question for you to reflect onto your relationships, your life overall, some silly things, as silly as list down 3 silly pieces of advice people gave you and one that you actually applied and tested. As practical as that. And these journals will be available by end of May online at Project Fuel website, and people can buy that and use that as a source to document all that life is teaching them and all that they're paying attention to. So that's something very exciting.
Unbelievable. Deepak, if people want to find you, they can find you at projectfuel.in. Anywhere else that they can find you on the internet that you'd like to let us know of?
Okay, so the website is a great place. And then, of course, Facebook is also an active platform. Facebook and Instagram, both Project Fuel and my name, Deepak Ramola. You can search either or of them. And there's a lot of information, a lot of good articles, especially on Project Fuel. Laura, there are some incredible blog posts that you can read. In fact, we did a story last year. There's a place in India where people check in to die, a hotel, and it's called Mukti Bhavan, the Salvation Home. And in the Hindu mythology, it's said that if you die in a particular city next to the holy river of Ganga, you attain salvation. So a lot of people who believe deeply into the spiritual Hindu mythology come to this place to check in. And I spent a week last year with these people. Now, the funny part is, which your audience will find humorous as well, is that this hostel or hotel only allows people to check in for 2 weeks. Okay, so you have to be really sure that you're going to die in 2 weeks. If you don't, you have to check out.
Oh my God.
So I spoke to the manager of this place, and he has been the manager for 44 years, has seen 12,000 deaths, and has cared for 12,000 people who came to attain salvation and die in that abode. And we did an article called 12 Life Lessons from the guy who's seen 12,000 deaths. And I definitely recommend for your audience to read it, because those are some precious gems for someone who's seen it all, I feel.
Oh my God, 25 years old. Deepak, you are incredible. I can't wait to watch you over the next 5 years if this is what you've done in these first few. It's incredible. You're an inspiration. Thank you so much for coming on The Art of Authenticity, sharing your story. I am definitely a fan. I will come over to your site and check it out. All of his links will be on our website if anybody is interested. And thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing, and thanks for sharing it.
Thank you so much, Laura. You are an inspiration absolutely and truly to me as well. And I'm glad that, you know, you're creating this beautiful network and amalgamation of stories for your audience, more joy in sharing and living it. So thank you so much and all the amazing work you're brewing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.